So today's topic, so I had a little bit of a mix-up with Rabbi Kalman. I kind of assumed that we were going to be doing the topic that we missed last week on the camel, the hair, and the hyrax, but he said the ad already went out for Shmonas Shvatzim. So we're going to do the Shmonas Shvatzim today, and we'll see what else we get. So let's go through to our hall of small animals. Okay, so here's our hall of small animals you can see around me here. And the smaller animals, many smaller animals mentioned in the Torah, and they create an interesting case study for the question of animal identification. Oh, by the way, I just noticed something cool. If somebody writes a comment, it just does pop up on my phone here, so that's fine. I am seeing the comments. And also let me know, there may be some visitors coming through. So if it gets too noisy for you to hear me, let me know, and then we'll move to a different. I have to change topic and move to a different room. Okay, so the question is, when the Torah mentions an animal, right? How do we know what it is? So if it's the aryeh, no, it's just obvious that it's a lion. Or sometimes you will have pesukim verses that give different clues about the animal, and based on those clues, we can, descriptive clues, we can figure out the animal's identity. But when it comes to the smaller animals of the Torah, so very often there's not that much written about them, and it's very often very difficult to know what they are. And on the other hand, though, with the in a way that's a good thing, right? Because it's have all different kinds of views as to what the animals are, and as far as I'm concerned, it means there's many, many more types of animals that we get an excuse to exhibit in the museum. So all this multiplicity of opinions about what these small animals are works out just great for me. I'm really thrilled about it. So many of the references to these smaller animals occurs in the list of the Shmoneh Shvatim. Right, hold on. I'm gonna show it to you. Oops, catch my phone and see if we can see it here. Right, here is the verse as it appears in the Torah. I hope you can see it. V'zeh lochem hatameh v'sheretz hashoreitz al ha'aretz atoleh v'ha'ashba v'ha'tzav l'minehu v'ha'anokel v'ha'koach v'ha'letah v'ha'tomet. These are eight creatures about which the Torah says, there's a lot of confusion about this. It's not talking about eating them here. Obviously not eating them. It's talking about tumah, about ritual impurity. And it's not talking about ritual impurity. Another misconception, people say, I can't touch my pet lizard. Firstly, it's talking about dead ones. It's not talking about live creatures. It's talking about dead creatures. And also, it's not a prohibition against touching them. You're allowed to become tameh. Obviously, it's something that's considered to be unpleasant in a certain way, but there's not actually a prohibition against it. So, before we get to identifying what these eight sheretzim are, first of all, let's talk about the term sheretz. What does sheretz mean? It does not have a precise English translation. Possibly, the closest you might get would be reptile, but not in the modern scientific English sense of the word reptile, in the old English sense of the word reptile, when it meant, some kind of small, vermin, scurrying, repulsive creature. Because as we're going to see, the list of sheretzim includes mammals also. All right, so it's small mammals and reptiles that scurry along the ground. All right, we're not talking about big mammals here. We're not talking about even with reptiles. We're not talking about crocodiles. We're not talking even about snakes. All right, sheretzim here are small scurrying creatures, be they mammal or reptile. So someone said creepy crawly. Obviously, the problem is that in English, at least in British English, which I'm most familiar with, creepy crawly means an insect. And these sheretzim, they're not insects. None of them are insects, right? We're talking about vertebrates here, right? Mammals and reptiles, not insects. So it's something, above the level of insect, but below the next level, which is behemoth, chaya, and so on. So, okay, so again, sheretz is a difficult word to describe, but to translate, I might just use the word sheretz, I might use the word reptile, just see what comes out of my mouth. But before we get on to identifying the sheretzim, what's interesting is the whole idea of it.
What is this whole idea that you have a list of eight creeping creatures that you become tame if you touch? And it actually, it's funny, actually, it really bothered me. You know, I've been running the museum here this for 10 years, and I had this exhibit for 10 years, and it was always bothering me. Okay, so we're getting all excited about identifying these animals and so on, but what's the halakha actually about? And I couldn't really understand it until about a year or two ago, when I was reading books on social psychology, and one particular book by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind. It's a wonderful book on many, many levels. I cannot recommend it highly enough. But it's also a tremendous book about insights into Ta'amei HaMitzvot, the reasons for the commandments, even though that is absolutely not the purpose of the book. It's a book on social psychology. But in explaining different value systems, and in fact, the book is really about, you know, why are good people divided by politics and religion? But you can have good people who will have radically different views on politics, radically different views on religion. So he gets into the idea of some of the of ideologies and values, different types of values that are found in politics and religion. And a lot of his insights work tremendously for understanding some of the mitzvot. Sorry, we have an animal doing some bashing something here. Hold on. Can you find one of the staff going on with their that seems to be locked in the hut? Find somebody who's on staff. Who's a good animal? Abby got the one, and that's what's going on with the hut and ground inside the box. Hi, back with you. Abby. Yeah. Something going on? There's a lot of banging going on over there. The Walter's enclosure. Okay. Sorry, what's happening today in the museum is that just under an hour, we've got a special tailet workshop starting, and people are going to be arriving and walking around the museum before that. But we have a bunch of new volunteers here who are helping prepare for that. Anyway, where was I? Shuatzim, yes, the reason. So what is the reason? What is the explanation? What is this list in the Torah all about? So indebted to Jonathan Haidt's book for opening my eyes to it, once I got the explanation, you know, it's so clearly there in the Torah. It's the idea of disgust, that much as it may not be correct in today's climate to talk about certain creatures being disgusting, and I personally, as you can imagine, you know, I absolutely adore all these creatures, but much as I love them, and much as I've been obsessed with lizards for most of my life, I certainly get that for many people, they're kind of, ugh. Right? People get the shudders, people recoil at them. I mean, certainly we can see that with visitors at the museum until they learn to appreciate their beauty. And certainly if we're talking about dead ones, right? Which is also very much a vector for disease, right? We can certainly understand that it would be a very healthy response to be disgusted by dead vermin. And that is what the Torah is trying to do here. It wants us to cultivate a sense of disgust. Now, so why? Why does the Torah want us to cultivate a sense of disgust? So the idea is that disgust is the opposite of striving for sanctity. Right? It's the exact opposite of that. The Torah wants us to strive for sanctity. Right? We have to be special. We have to live up to a certain standard that's expected of us. Right? We have to be refined. So part of that is part of being pulled towards, it's not just enough to talk about the pull towards that, you also want to talk about the push away from the opposite, right? That we have to recoil from disgusting things because we don't want to be disgusting people. Or we can't just think, Torah doesn't want us to just think, yeah, you know, you can do anything, you know, you've no standards. No, you have to have standards. Right? I want to cultivate a sense of refinement, a sense of sanctity, a sense that certain things should be beneath us. So part of that is cultivating a sense of disgust. Right, so I think that's clearly the idea behind the idea of becoming tame if you touch a dead shirts. So now we get to the part I love, which is all about identifying the shiratzim, and we're also discussing why many of them were misidentified, which has great, great significance. Okay, so you see there's eight shiratzim in the list, right? So what we have here is the world's only exhibit of Shemana shiratzim.
We have eight different, like I have to keep it down doing the Zoom path. We have eight different exhibits here for the eight Shurat Sim. And what we have is for each of them, there's, you know, several opinions as to what they are. So in each section, we have all the potential candidates for that Shurat on exhibit. Okay, so we're going to start off over here with the very first one in the list, which is the holder. The holder. So what is a holder? And some identify it as an animal that's called in the Mishnah, In the Torah, it says choled. It's called the choled. And many identify it with the holder, which is an animal that's mentioned frequently in the Talmud. And I think it's fairly safe to assume that the choled and the holder are going to be the same animal. So what are these animals? So in modern Hebrew, holder, it means rat. Right? It means a rat. And how did the word holder come to mean rat in modern Hebrew? So when they were resurrecting Hebrew as a language and figuring out, you know, how to apply the names to the right animals. So they looked at the clues, right? The holder, the choled, the holder, we have clues. Not in Tanakh, but in the Gemara. As I said, the Gemara mentions the holder many times. And it says there's two things we know about the holder from the Gemara. One thing that we know is that the holder steals chametz. Right, the Gemara speaks about this, the holder taking your chametz and going and hiding it somewhere, you may have to search for it before Pesach. And the other thing we know about the holder from the Gemara is that it eats chickens, kills and eats chickens. Now, that is a very, very unusual combination. Right, normally, things we eat chickens are carnivores, right? And carnivores are not going to eat chametz. Things that eat chametz are, you know, rodents, and they're not going to be killing chickens. So what would eat chickens and chametz? So rats, right? Rats obviously eat chametz, and rats can get pretty big. And if you've seen any New York City sewer rats, they can get pretty big and savage, and they can kill a chicken. Right? They can be savage predators. But instead of having savage rats here, we prefer to have, you know, this part of the museum is much more hands-on. So we have our cuddly rats here. You got a rat? Here we go. Here we have a lovely rat. Right, so this is a domesticated rat, and they're amazing. Right, they're very intelligent. They're clean. They're really absolutely adorable. Our rats also do a lovely trick. Hey, guys, do you know the rat trick we do? Have you been taught the rat trick that we do with visitors? The trick with the rats. Have you been taught that? Yeah? You're going to do it from our Zoom class, okay? You guys are going to do it. It's a trick we put on for our visitors. Oh, I do go. I've got the camera this way. Turn around. There we go. So here are our new volunteers. Come on. Who's going to do it? You'll do it with her? You'll do it with her? Okay, not you. We'll just do the skills. There we go. All right. And this is our rat trick that we do. We can cut her back a bit. Ready? Okay. 3, 2, 1, go. There we go. There we go. That is our rat trick that visitors enjoy. So I said the rats are the rats we have are beautiful, but just because some people, you know, we do want to teach about the idea of disgust, we also have an absolutely disgusting rat here. Is he handleable? Yeah, he's handleable. There's another one in the bunny feet. Yeah, I'll take this one. Can I show my audience? All right, welcome to most disgusting rat ever. He is a special variety of hairless rat, and he has this mask on his face. Right, absolutely disgusting creature. So when he was born with this mutation that made him hairless, I wanted to just like get him, I said to the staff, just get him off exhibit. It's horrific. And they said, no, the visitors love it. The visitors love seeing this absolutely disgusting thing. Right, I don't like him. I much prefer the little, oh yeah, look at that. Adorable. Cute little baby rat. That's so cute. All right. So is this the holder? Is this the holder? So
seems to meet the qualifications. Rats eat comets, rats kill chickens. But I don't think it is. I'll tell you why. These, whatever animal matches these descriptions, right? These are descriptions given in the Gemara, right? So it has to be an animal that was here at the time of the Gemara, right? And these rats, these are brown rats. These are just happen to be a black and white color variety. But these, you know, these big rats that you find in the sewers all around the world, that the type is the brown rat. And it's generally accepted that they originate from Norway and that they haven't been in my part of the world. They only got to my part of the world within the last few hundred years. But the only rats that were here in biblical times were black rats, which are very small and certainly don't kill chickens. So therefore, I do not think that the brown rat is the correct candidate for the holder or the chole. So what are the other candidates? So there's a common tradition. Does anyone know what the common tradition that you learn in yeshiva as to what a chulda is?
A weasel?
A weasel. Correct. That is the tradition that's handed down from the medieval commentators, that it's a weasel. Now, the problem is, a weasel, we don't have a weasel here, unfortunately. Get a weasel. The weasels are hard to get. The problem with the weasel can't be the chulda, because a weasel, while a weasel would take on a chicken, maybe, but they don't eat hummets, right? They are strict, strict carnivores. But maybe we can look wider in the weasel family. And if we look wider in the weasel family, we find this animal. You know what this is? You know what that is? It is a marten. This is a marten, or martin, and his name is Aston. Aston Martin. Right? And martens, they'll kill chickens. And I was looking up, do martins take comets? And I found a lovely video on YouTube of a martin in someone's backyard eating bread. Right, so the martin will steal your comets and it will kill your chickens. I've never seen a wild martin in Israel now, but certainly they are theoretically an animal that's very widespread. Antiquity would have been very common, and they'll sometimes come near areas of human habitation. I'm actually on a group of people who spot mammals in Israel, and many people report finding martins coming into their attics or things like that. Right, so definitely this description of the cholder as an animal that's stealing comets and killing chickens would well match a martin. So that is our strongest candidate for the cholder. And again, it's not a reptile, it's a mammal, but on the smaller end of the mammal spectrum, right? Small scurrying mammal. Now let's move on to the next animal, which is the achbar. Now, the achbar is basically the only animal on this list that absolutely everyone agrees what it is. It's a mouse. Right? We know achbar is a mouse. How do we know it? It's widespread tradition. Absolutely universal tradition. No one's ever disputed that. Then there's the golden mice that are mentioned in Navi. But no one's ever disputed that achbar is a mouse. But we did still have a question about what exactly is a mouse. So if we're talking about, again, wild mice, there's different types of wild mice in Israel. Here we have that interesting mouse called spiny mouse, aren't they? You see them hiding in the hole there? You see them there? These are spiny mice, which are native to this country. I can't take them out because, again, these are wild animals, right? Completely not tame. Not only are they not tame, but they have a very bizarre defense mechanism that if you try and grab one, it sheds not just its tail, if you hold on to its tail, but it sheds its skin. And you end up holding the skin of the mouse. Not just the fur, the skin. It actually sheds its skin and then regenerates its skin. But it's a rather ugly-looking mouse. So we don't handle these ever. These are just for looks. A bunch of them hiding in there. Spiny mouse. But what we have to realize, again, is that when we're translating or interpreting Torah, we have to remember the limitations of a translation. In other words, just like the word sheretz, does not have an exact English translation, right? So too, when it comes to the definition of types, I think we spoke about this last time. It's not as though, when the Torah mentions a type of animal, that does not correlate with a species in English. It doesn't correlate with a genus or a family, right? It's just whatever, there's no way of measuring or defining exactly what a type is. A type is whatever the Jewish people would have understood a type to be. But certainly, achbar would not have been a species, right? It would have referred to all kinds of mice, right? Whether it be wild spiny mice or now domestic house mice. We have this lovely enclosure here of house mice. I think they are a bit fighty, but it's yeah, I don't give the tours usually anymore, and I'm not involved in animal handling, so I'm not always up on exactly which animal bite and it's dead. I don't know. It seems, I don't know, mice tend to be more bitey. There we go. Everyone's familiar with a little mouse. Cute to watch them climbing around this cage. Yeah, if you want a closer look. There we go. Lots of little mice doing their thing. But again, not only would it include, you know, spiny mice, house mice, it would also include other small rodents, hamsters, gerbils, guinea pigs, right? These would all be considered achbar in the Torah's system of classification. They're really bitey. We have a bunch of hamsters, of dwarf hamsters, but they're really bitey, and I'm not in the mood to get bitten today. I've been bitten too many times in my life. All right, so we've been through the choled, we've been through the achbar, and next is the tzav. Okay, what's a tzav? Anyone know? Type it in the chat box. What's a tzav?
Turtle.
So, you're correct that in modern Hebrew, tzav refers to a turtle. There we go. We've got lots of turtles here in our turtle box. There we go. We've got big turtles. We've got little turtles. Tiny newborn turtles, and we've also got giant turtles, and maybe we'll go and meet a little bit later. But the fact that tzav means turtle in modern Hebrew and does not mean that that's what it means in biblical Hebrew.
Right?
There we go. We can't assume that just that's what we were taught tzav means, that that's what it actually means. Now, for example, if we look at Rashi identifies tzav as a different creature. Got one up here. Rashi identifies tzav as a toad. Right, a toad. Here's a beautiful toad. I love toads. They have the most beautiful eyes. It's golden eyes. So this is a rather large toad. He's actually far from full grown. He's a juvenile of the largest type of toad in the world, Bufo marinus, the marine toad. They can get it to be the size of a dinner plate. And they're the ones also that have become pests in Australia. But I love them. Now, the toads that live in Israel are a different type of toad. We have green toads here. We have cat-eye toads, otherwise known as spadefoot toads. This is a toad, and this is how Rashi identifies the tzav. But there's other opinions too. Yeah. The Sadi Agon identifies tzav as a Euromastix lizard. A Euromastix lizard.
Now, Euromastix lizards.
Look at these. Aren't they beautiful? Got a red one, got a yellow one. Right, Euromastix lizards in the Agama family. They live in the desert. This is actually not the Israeli species. This is the African species. The Israeli ones get quite large, to about 2 feet long. And they have a very soft skin in their body, and they have very, very spiky tails. And when danger comes, they go into like crevices in the rock, and they kind of inflate their tummies. So the predator can only get to the spiky tail and can't pull them out because they've kind of inflated themselves inside the rock. So this is what's known in Arabic as a zab, and that's how Sadi Gon, who gives, you know, Arabic identifications for the animals, this is how he identifies zab. So you've got this. So obviously the question is, you know, what's going on? You've got three very diverse identifications for the tzav. You've got Rashi, who says it's a toad. You've got Sadi Gon, who says that it's a Euromastix lizard. also known as a dab lizard in English. I like the Arabic word again, sab. And then you've got the popular view that it's a turtle, or what we in England call a tortoise. Right? And the tortoise also based on certain of the Rishonim, evil tarot cards. So, you know, which one is correct? We don't have much to go on here, but I would just say that Rav Sadia Gaon here has the most reliability. Well, firstly, you know, why are there these radically different views? Again, the reason is they lived in different parts of the world. And in different parts of the world, you have different animals. So since Rav Sadia Gaon lived in Egypt and Israel, right, he was local. So I think that's what gives him the most credibility here in identifying Tzav as a Euromastix lizard. But I wouldn't say 100%. Okay. So next, after the Tzav, we have the Anaka. What is an Anaka? So Rashi says that it's a hedgehog. Fortunately, we do not have a hedgehog at the moment. He's gone to the great hedgehog cage in the sky. But instead of a hedgehog, what we have is, well, we had our hedgehog living in here. We also had to something that many people confuse a hedgehog with, which is a porcupine. This porcupine is not live, stuffed. So we know the advantage of stuffed animals is that they don't die on you. And hedgehog is not to be confused with a porcupine. Porcupines, well, and I guess most of you are watching from the US, the porcupines in the US are very different from the porcupines here. Like, the porcupines in the US are kind of furry, with just some spikes bedded down. The porcupines in this part of the world, they have just tons and tons of spikes, and when they feel danger, they make their spikes stand up, and it's this huge thing, like, you know, it's like nearly 3 feet long, and then nearly 3 feet tall, and it's huge, massive spikes. And they're very different from a hedgehog, which is a much, much smaller animal, has very, very short spines. And when a hedgehog's threatened, it rolls up into a ball, into a little prickly ball. Right? Porcupines will face you off with these huge spines sticking up, and they'll try and charge you backwards. And then the spines are very loosely attached. So what happens is they charge you backwards, they stick the spines into you, and then the quills, and then they run forwards, leaving the quills detached, and you're left stuck in them. Right? Sometimes in Africa, you'll see a lion with a face full of porcupine quills. But hedgehogs are very, very short quills that do not detach, and they roll up into a ball. And they're also very different creatures. Hedgehogs are insectivores, insect-eating creatures that eat slugs and other bugs, whereas porcupines are actually rodents, and they have a herbivorous stomach. Right, so Rashi says that the Anaka is the hedgehog. Right, but then others say that the Anaka is a type of lizard, specifically the gecko. See what geckos we can find here. Okay, so here we have a lovely leopard gecko. Very, very beautiful creature called a leopard gecko. It's spotted like a leopard. And again, magical eye. A lot of these creatures, the camera's not really picking it up, but it has these beautiful, deep-colored eyes. Now, leopard geckos, which are popular as pets, are actually not very typical geckos. They're very unusual for geckos because they just have regular feet. What geckos are better known for, apart from selling car insurance, is having a sticky. And you have a sticky foot of type of gecko. Fine. Okay, this is a crested gecko because he has a lovely, delicate little crest above his eyes. This particular one, so he shed his tail, currently tailless. And what this gecko can do is what geckos are famous for, which is sticking to walls. And stick it on the glass right here. Okay, and he was quite happy to stick to the glass. Whoops. Jeez. You're facing a live audience here. Good job. And it can stick to the glass and crawl up it. And actually, the scientific explanation of how they do that is really amazing. Basically, if you were to look at a gecko's feet under an electron microscope, what you see is it looks like a forest. All these branches and leaves, these microscopic structures in its feet. So if I put my hand on a piece of glass, right, it might look like I'm making full contact, but on a molecular level, there's actually very few molecules of my hand that are actually touching the glass. And on a molecular level, this glass is not smooth at all. It's mountains and valleys, and so there's very few parts of my hand that are actually coming into contact with it. But because the surface of the gecko's feet have all these branching structures on them, so they work their way into the crack, so the gecko makes very close contact. And then it's not gripping at that molecular level, but what happens is that all molecules attract each other with a very, very slight force called van der Waals forces. And these forces are so weak that you don't feel yourself, sticking to things when you touch them. But because the gecko is making such incredibly close contact with the surface due to these structures on its feet, so the cumulative effect of these forces is that it's able to stick to it. Now, again, we have two really different views. Is the anaca, right? Oh, and some people say that the anaca being a gecko maybe has to do with the noise that it makes. Actually, you hear geckos at night in Israel. You hear geckos a lot at night going, sound like that. So some people suggest maybe anaca is onomatopoeic and it has to do with the noise they make. speculative, but the interesting thing is that you have two completely different views as to what the anaca is. Now, a hedgehog and a gecko are about as different as two animals can be. So what's that about? Well, firstly, it means that nobody ultimately really knows, but also it means that there were very different traditions in different parts of the world. Rashi, was in France, right? And others were in different parts of the world in the Middle East. So ultimately, I have to say, I think Rashi has less credibility because being so far geographically from Israel, where the animal life is so different, I think it's much more likely that the traditions were corrupted as it went to Europe. But impossible to know for sure. Okay, so we've had the Soled, we've had the Achbar, we've had the Tsar, we've had the Anaka. Our next is the Koach. Now, Koach has been translated in different ways, some even translated as a crocodile. I don't think a crocodile is a sheretz. Right, and crocodile already has a perfectly good name in Tanakh, Tanin. But many suggest that given that Korach means strength, it would refer to a very strong sheretz, and that would be the monitor lizard. Now, our monitor lizard is currently taking a bath. It's a very dirty bath. He poops in his bath. Hold on. See if we can get him out of his bath. Here, monitor lizards, they get very large. This is an Asian water monitor, and he's about pushing 6 feet. He is a very, very formidable animal. He is the only animal in the museum that we're all scared to hold. He has a tail that can lash out with tremendous strength. He has very, very strong and sharp claws, and his teeth are unbelievably sharp. And also have a very nasty set of bacteria. In fact, some people think that monitors' saliva actually should be classified as toxic, as venomous, because of all the nasty bacteria that's in it. I mean, it's a cousin of the Komodo dragon. Right? The largest type of monitor lizard is the Komodo dragon, and it lives on the island of Komodo, right off Indonesia. What they'll sometimes do is they'll bite the water buffalo, and then they just wait for the water buffalo to die of the infection. They'll follow the water buffalo around for the next day or two, until the buffaloes died of the infection from the bite. So monitor lizards also have a very nasty bite. In fact, I've been bitten by many things in my career. I've been bitten by snakes. I've been bitten by lions. I've always got a bite from a small lion. I've been bitten by lots and lots of things. The worst bite I ever got was from a monitor lizard. It was not this one. It was a different one that we had when we started the museum, a much smaller one. And I was teaching, we had this new volunteer. And I was teaching him, how to handle them. And I said, all right, let's take out the monitor lizard. And, we have these big, big, thick, heavy leather gloves for handling, animals that might bite or scratch. And he said to me, well, don't you want to put the gloves on? And I said, nah, we're all men here. No gloves needed. And, of course, 30 seconds later, I was squealing like a little girl because the monitor had sunk his jaws into my hand. I could not believe how deep the bite was. The amount of blood was just unbelievable. Emergency medical visit, antibiotics for all the bacteria. So a monitor lizard is absolutely something not to be bitten by. And that's why we have these warning signs here. Warning, this animal can bite. There was one night when I was giving a Zoom late here in the museum. We also had a workman here, and the monitor lizard had escaped. And I found him, and what to do? Basically, I threw myself down on top of him. It's like literally sitting on him so his tail couldn't thrash me and holding his head down. And I was thrashing around, and I was trying to tell there was a workman here, a Russian workman, and I was saying, grab his tail, but he didn't know any English. He just kept on, running out and running back into the room, giving me different things. No, no, tail, tail. And finally, he twigged. I couldn't spare a hand, but I had to hold down his head. Finally, he twigged, and he held the tail, and we managed to get him back to the cage. I'm going to start water. Just remembered something. We have a backup monitor. monitors are incredibly, incredibly expensive animals here in Israel. Pretty pricey in the US too. And a while ago, I saw somebody on the local email list advertising a baby monitor for just 150 shekels. 150 shekels for a monitor? There were thousands. So I was just about to call them when I realized they weren't selling a baby monitor. They were selling a baby monitor. But more recently, actually, we did find an animal dealer who actually did have a baby monitor of the baby monitor, right? And we traded some animals for it. So he's down here, and he's much more handleable. I'll try and get him out. Going to you. I haven't actually handled him before, but the other staff have handled him, and they say he's okay. Maybe we'll just play this safe. There we go. He's a good boy. All right. Here we have our juvenile water monitor. You see his tongue flicking out. Very long forked tongue. He is a very, very active animal. Growing rapidly on a strictly carnivorous diet of rodents. Well, our bigger one, we feed him on chicken. He like gobbles up pieces of chicken. Wow, oh, good boy. I really need to handle these animals more often. So just wait until I'm giving a live class. Okay, he's getting a bit frisky. Pop him back. Could have gone much worse. Right, so that is what some identify as power. Because our monitor lizards are a handful, and we like our visitors to interact with our animals, so we got a parallel animal from South America. And given that the Torah is giving categories and names of animals that are in the Middle East, and other parts of the world you don't have them, but there might be other things that fall into very similar, categories, right? So like, the equivalent of the Nesher, the griffin vulture in the Torah, would be, say, the condor of North America. So the equivalent of the The tegu. This is one of our tegus. Also a giant lizard, but incredibly cuddly. And thank God never bitten anyone. Much more easy to handle. And he's just, look at him. He's just adorable. And you'll see tegus have these gigantic cheeks. And absolutely gigantic cheeks. And the reason why they have those cheeks is so that you can do this. Yes, you are. All right, so this is our tegu, right? Basically the equivalent giant lizard from South America, and they are fabulous. We've got three of them in the museum, and the visitors absolutely love them. Say hello. Hello. All right, pop him back into his enclosure. Yeah. Here's his partner. Black and white. Whoa. Okay. Relax. There we go. This is partner. She's black and white. All right. Thank you. Okay, well, some identify the co-op as the monitor, but there's also a tradition that refers to a gamma lizard. The gamma lizards are the small lizards you see basking in lots of rocks and so on in Israel. We don't have the native Israeli species of any of these animals. And the reason is that it's clear that we should have Teva, the nature authority that we work with. They don't want people keeping, even institutions, they don't want people keeping, they're not thrilled about keeping native Israeli species in captivity. And also the native Israeli species are not good for handling. We want our visitors to handle our animals. So basically, you see what we have is, you know, the equivalence, right? Instead of having the Israeli toad, right, we've got a South American toad. Instead of having the Israeli geckos, we've got leopard geckos and crested geckos. Instead of the Israeli monitor lizard, which is the desert monitor of the Negev, which is a very, very nervous and flighty creature and aggressive, we've got monitor lizards, the water monitors from Asia, which can be tamed down and much less aggressive. So instead of the Israeli agamas, we have the Australian bearded lizards, which is also in the agama family, and which are very, very tame and easy to handle. Okay, so there's a bearded dragon. All right. Next, we have the Lata. Now, Lata is the only thing of which there's a universal tradition, which is lizard. Everyone has had Lata as a lizard. We've already been looking at lizards, right? We looked at Euromastix lizards. We looked at geckos. We looked at monitor lizards and agamas. So those are all lizards. So Lata is generally understood to refer to like a less specialized, like a more classic type of lizard. Just, you know, bright green lizard scurrying around. Now, Israel used to have a lot of these very prominent, beautiful, bright green lizards, whose technical name in English is green lizard. And these were very common in Israel. Unfortunately, once the British introduced the cats, that was the end of it for the lizards. So now that I believe there's a few lizards, green lizards still left in the wild in Israel. Never seen one. Very rarely seen. Very unfortunate because it was a beautiful animal. What we have here is a different green lizard, water dragons. Someone asked about the, we have signs. Yeah, above every enclosure, we have signs explaining the idea of what's the biblical animal and what's the idea of what it is and what we have represented here. So water dragons, very, very beautiful lizards. She is, and what a beauty. Shedding her skin a bit. Just help her a bit with that. So I can't never resist peeling a lizard's skin. It's a satisfying thing to do. There we go. It's revealing the beauty underneath. There we go. Look at those colors. Absolutely beautiful. We're very proud of our water dragon colony. They have bred very successfully, have incubated and hatched. Happy, how many water dragons have we hatched so far? 40? Something like that. Stop counting. All right, we breed water dragons, we sell them, a beautiful lizard, and it can actually be very calm. Even though they can be very flighty, beautiful long tail, look at that. Now, of course, lizards can shed their tail. In fact, there's an interesting Gemara which talks about Gemara discussing definition of life, what's alive. Like if something is dead but still moving, you know, is it alive? And the Gemara discusses the idea of a tail of a lizard. Right? Lizards, when danger comes, they can shed their tails. Right? They all contract. Oops, sorry, didn't mean to scare you. They contract a certain muscle at the base of their tail that makes their tail drop off, and then the tail goes wriggling around by itself. Example of something that seems to be alive, but is certainly not halachically considered as being alive. Ramifications for the brain death debate and so on. All right, so representing the lizard family, we have these beautiful water dragons. Oh, I don't know if you can. No, this one. So it'll show up. All right. Now, next we have the chomet. Chomet. What is a chomet? So Rashi says that chomet is a snail, a land snail. Now we have a colony of giant African snails here. snails are a little bit tricky because they tend to, you know, crawl everywhere and get slime everywhere. And what we found is that copper, snails hate copper. It emits a tiny electrical charge when they touch copper, which they hate. So you can buy copper tape. All right, so we have copper tape. You can see it here around the cage that we put at the top of the cage. And in general, this one, they just cross the barrier. In general, they don't like crossing the copper tape, so they don't get onto the glass or onto the lights. So that's what Rashi says chomet is. And to be honest, it seems like a very difficult explanation. Because the shiratzim in this list, they're rodents and mammals. They're rodents and small carnivorous mammals and reptiles. It's vertebrates. To say that it started including now an invertebrate just seems to be very strange. Invertebrates seem to be a different category in the Torah. Ramasim, not shiratzim. I mean, where's the male water? I don't see any of the in there. I have to say, identity snail is difficult. And the generally accepted translation of chomet is a skink. Now, skinks are yet another family of lizards. Very known as snake-like lizards. There are all types of skinks in Israel. I mean, we don't have the Israeli species on exhibit here at the museum. We have instead an Australian species. The blue-tongued skink. This is actually the largest skink in the family. These skinks are very, very snake-like. They have short legs, sometimes incredibly short legs. In fact, sometimes there's even legless lizards, don't have any legs at all. And those would probably be classified in the Torah as nachash. Right? And those who want to identify one of the shiratzim as a legless lizard. But I think if a lizard doesn't have any legs at all, then the Torah wouldn't even consider it a lizard. The Torah would consider it a snake. So, chomet appears to be a skink family, lizards with very, very short legs. And this is the blue-tongued skink from Australia. And why is he called a blue-tongued skink? Stick out your tongue. Stick out your tongue. Come on. Not the tongue. Taste my finger. Please, stick out your tongue. In front of the live studio audience. No, punk pop eight. All right. He has a bright blue tongue. So, it's a skink. And we also have a zebra skink. They're hiding and I can't get them out. All right. So we're now down to the last sheretz on the list, which is the tinshamet. What is a tinshamet? There have been all kinds of different identifications. Some identify it as a mole, and others identify it as yet another type of lizard. A chameleon. This is a very, very beautiful chameleon. His name is Zachariah. And there's chameleons in Israel. Again, we do not, the Israeli species does not dwell in captivity at all. Far too nervous. So this is a Yemenite chameleon, known as a veiled chameleon. Gigantic helmet here. Now, chameleons, of course, they're best known for their color-changing ability. Not happening. Why is it not happening? Because it's a myth. They do change color, but they do not change color for camouflage. They change color for mood. Mood and other things like that, not camouflage. So he's feeling kind of green and bold. Now, chameleons, there's much more amazing things about chameleons than color changing. And if we're talking about color changing, it's octopuses by far the world leader for color changes. Octopuses can change their color and the texture of their skin in an instant to match their surroundings. Chameleons are much more impressive things. Firstly, their eyes. Now, you can see his eyes swivel and turn, and they can actually swivel independently, which means that in his brain, just like you have, say, a split screen and monitor in a Zoom session, right, that's what he's getting in his head, two completely separate images. And when he sees his prey, his eyes will lock together forwards, and then that will give him the depth perception, and he'll know how far away he is from his prey. Avi, will he feed on command by hand? Can you get me something? All right, then he has these amazing hands that the toes are fused together like pincers. See that? Gives him a very tight grip. It also means that chameleons are excellent at doing Birkat HaKohanim. Let me show you Birkat HaKohanim. There we go. You want to reach up, reach up, reach up. Here we go. Yivarech Echa. All right, they got a Birkat HaKohanim. They also have this amazing tail, which coils up. And unlike other lizards that shed their tails for danger, chameleons never shed their tails. Instead, they do the opposite. Right? They hang on with their tails. Their tails are incredibly strong, and it can actually hang its entire weight from its tail. And then the final thing that's amazing about chameleons is how they feed. They have a tongue, which is as long as their body, and it's all squished up inside their mouth. And when they see an insect, so they move towards it very slowly, and they shake as they move. So they look like leaves blowing in the wind. Right? They shake, move themselves towards it. They open their mouth a little bit, and then they have a muscle that basically squeezes around the end of their tongue, like when you squeeze like a melon seed, and it shoots out. So that's what it does. And then at the end of their tongue, at the end of the tongue, they have another muscle with a suction cup, and which kind of sticks to the insect and draws it back into its mouth. So here, we have a mealworm, lovely fresh mealworm. Let's see if he wants to eat it. You want to eat it? Oh, it's going out of my hand. Can you keep the mealworm in my hand? Or are we going to do it from the tweezers? We'll do it from the tweezers. Wait, let me go a distance. Manzakaria. Mealworm. Do it. Yeah, get a bit further away. The other way, he sees it. Oh, he's thinking about it. Come on, Zakaria, go, go, go. Suspense is killing me. Ah, there we go. Munch, munch, munch. Now, incredible animal. Now, so do we think that Tin Shamet is actually the chameleon? So I do. I think it is. I think it's a chameleon, not a mole, not any of those other candidates. And I'll tell you why. In the list of non-kosher birds, there is also a Tin Shamet. There's something else called a Tin Shamet, a bird called a Tin Shamet, and that bird is identified as, right above me here, barn owl. There we go. See our barn owl circling towards the camera, and barn owl. So there is a bird called a Tin Shamet and a reptile called a Tin Shamet. Now, I think is that there's something which is fundamentally similar about a barn owl and a Tin Shamet, the reptile Tin Shamet, which is why they would share the same name. But Tin Shamet may be based on the word nashima, which means to breathe. When you go near barn owls on a nest, so they'll go, it's very loud breathing, hissing movement. And when you go near, see, this is where this chameleon doesn't work. He's very tame. But if you go near a wild chameleon, what they do is the exact same thing, hissing with air and puffing themselves up. In fact, in Shakespeare, there's a reference to chameleons eating air. There's a belief that they actually live on air. And that's what they eat as their food. They puff themselves up with this hissing and as they gaping in the air. So Tin Shamet would therefore mean, you know, the heavy breather, right? The creature that does this heavy breathing. And then in the bird form of the Tin Shamet would be the barn owl, and the reptile form of the Tin Shamet would be the chameleon. Hopping back into the stage. I got some female here somewhere. She's hiding. You've bred chameleons here at the past in the museum. Absolutely amazing to watch the little babies coming out of the eggs. So that brings us to the age of Shemana Shiratzin. We also have, I've just briefly mentioned, other sources that are smaller animals. Frogs, which interestingly are not mentioned in the list of Shiratzin. Right, a frog is not a sheretz. It's not clear why, maybe because it's aquatic. Snakes aren't in the list of Shiratzin. Why not? I don't know. That one's a riddle for me. Frogs are, of course, mentioned elsewhere in Tanakh, the plague of frogs in Egypt. So we've got a lovely tree frog here. Yeah. It's really cute little tree frogs. Looks like Kermit. All right. Back and again, like geckos, tree frogs can stick to glass, so they do it with a different mechanism than geckos. They use van der Waals forces. They use adhesion. Those are like sticky. And then we have a really cute frog called a pixie frog. Take out our pixie frog for you. Alright. Here is our pixie frog. Pixie frog. Well, pixie comes from the Latin name for them. It's an African bullfrog. very, very large frog. He happily eats baby rats. He also once ate a baby python. No, he is not a trivial character. But if you kiss him, he turns into a very handsome prince.
All right, so I hope you enjoyed meeting some of our live animals
here at the museum. I'll also mention now we're starting our Tales workshop at the museum, but don't worry that you can't join it in person. You can read all about Tales. We have a new article on our knowledge base. And the museum has a website, biblicalnaturalhistory.org, biblicalnaturalhistory.org. And if you go to our website, we have a section of resources, and amongst our resources are a knowledge base. We have all kinds of articles about different animals in the Torah. We have an article on the swordfish that we looked at last week, so all the sources to do with that. And we have an article on Tehillet, on the identity of Tehillet, right, which is something that comes up in this week's parasha. Tehillet is used in our tzitzit. So thank you very much for joining me here. Any questions? You can type in the text.
Do you have pictures of the things that you have that are the non-Israeli version? Do you have that, even though you say that this is not the Israeli one, this is the Asian or whatever, do you have pictures of the Israeli ones?
We don't, but we should be adding that to our signage, and it's on our list. We want to redo the signage with pictures, and that's what we don't want to do. We also want to get models of the Israeli ones. Any other questions?
I know this. Thank you very much. I wanted to ask you about the safari. You mentioned a couple of weeks ago about maybe doing a safari again, and I was wondering
It's not happening this summer. A lot going on in Israel right now. But we're shooting for next summer in Kenya.
Next summer in Kenya?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much. It's wonderful.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And I hope last week was okay. I know I got a bit distracted at the end with the swordfish, but it was very exciting and distracting.
It was fun to see.
Great.
It was really neat.
It
fit in our freezer with like this much room to spare.
Thank you so much. Love
Thank
it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank
You're
you.
You're welcome.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.